question of the Penobscot Bay House and the daughter, but of our company itself. Timber and lumber orders stacked high, but Hank Stane not to be found. He is gone. No letter, no word. The wretch! There is nobody to serve as our bookkeeper. No one to serve as looker of woodland. Sedley, in grief over loss of his wife, lies ill abed. Your wife's upset and calling your return. Bernard's wife, Birgit, tears her hair with sorrow. Return quick, we may marshal our forces in business. Charter a ship ere all is lost. Your loving brother and uncle, Niklaus Duke.
37. Change. In later years, Pete Duke thought sometimes of Nikolaus's nightmare letter and the hurried arrangements and great expense of taking passage back to Boston. Outre had not returned with them. Since then, he and George and Sedley had suffered under the controlling leadership of Jan and Nikolaus, who allowed no innovation except closing down portions of the business. So the Carolina plantation was sold, and Pete assigned the task of handling the New England logging jobbers. The Quebec holdings diminished. Jan managed what remained of those forest lands. Nikolaus served as the company president at the Boston headquarters. But as Jan and Nikolaus doddered on, they gradually allowed Pete and George a greater say in business decisions, though still watching from the sidelines. And today the cousins had a chance to make an important change. Pete combed at his thinning hair with his fingers, adjusted his stock, and moved his shoulders inside his coat. He called Oliver Wedge, his secretary, a rural youth with aspirations beyond maize and cows, the first secretary Duke and Sons had ever hired, and now indispensable.
"Are the papers ready?"
he asked Wedge, who pointed to a squared-up stack of pages. Wedge loved his job passionately, loved being in Boston and away from the farm and its futile, never-ending work. Away from his father's anger at marauding wild animals, anger that Wedge and his six hard-worked brothers shared. Huge flocks of birds pulled up the sprouted seeds, especially corn, beloved by turkeys, squirrels, crows, red-winged blackbirds, and a thousand other avian robbers, raccoons and bears. The raccoons got the eggs the hens laid, and the fox, hawks, falcons, skunks, wolves and weasels killed the hens. Bears took the pigs and calves and once a full-grown cow. Sheep were impossible as long as wolves and catamounts and lynx and bobcats could get their scent. But he thought squirrels were the worst, as there were thousands upon thousands of them, the forest and woodlot alive with the furry devils, red, black, gray squirrels. And he knew for a fact that two squirrels could make 6, 7, even 9 more squirrels every year, and each of these was soon mature. He tried to work out how many squirrels one pair created over, say, 10 years, but the sums became so large they frightened him. The earth might be carpeted with squirrels in his lifetime. And woodchucks ate salads, cabbage, turnips, onions, and beans. The house swarmed with mice, more than one cat could ever catch. He would never go back.
"You are sure that the papers are ready?" Pete could not stop asking. "Yes, Mr. Duke, everything is ready."
Wedge's long, knobby fingers, early trained to pull thistles, now flew among papers, creating order. Although he had been employed as a secretary for only a year, he had learned much of Boston life. From a dirty manuscript folded in the back of an account book, a furious, rambling critique by a man who signed himself Hank Stane. Stane was aggrieved at the cruelties beyond slavery that he saw in the colonies. Husbands who beat their wives with iron pokers until ribs crackled. An overbearing bully who pushed a road through an elderly widow's property. Thieving servants branded with B for burglary. The many who fornicated before marriage. Trespassing swine, barrels of rotten fish sold as sound, breaches of peace, drunkenness and swearing. It was a wonderfully wicked place. Silence and late afternoon spring sunlight filled the second-floor conference room. Four stacks of paper, glittering inkwells, and sharpened quills rested on the company's long maple table, constructed from four planks after the humiliating failure to wrest Duquet's old single-board pine table away from Outre's daughter. Pete checked his watch again and again. He feared this coming meeting, but it seemed the only way to get ahead. For years, the King's men had robbed both crown and colony by granting lands, while securing for themselves the adjoining 500-acre corners of those grants, until they had amassed thousands of the richest, most heavily timbered acres. They and the important landholders clubbed together. That was how the Wentworth brothers and brothers-in-law, the Elisha Cooks, and their cronies, had made their fortunes, by stealth and holding. Duke and Sons, perpetual outsiders, had never gotten involved in politics. If the younger men had not been forced by Bernard's death to assume junior positions in the company, they might have moved into rich political offices. It would have been useful to have a Duke as the governor of Massachusetts or Maine or even New York. Now that England had New France entirely within her claws, everything was very different. This time, Duke and Sons had the upper hand, thought Pete. The entrenched political landholders with their great swathes of coastal pine had suffered tremendous losses a year earlier when an epic wildfire strode out of New Hampshire and incinerated 50 miles of seacoast forest, eating deep miles inland until beneficent rain fell. Duke and Sons' chief holdings were along the interior rivers, a long distance from the fire. Even before the ashes cooled, men whose timber had been destroyed looked covetously on the Duke timberlands. He consulted his new waistcoat watch. Half an hour to wait. Half an hour to stare out the north window. Once, illimitable forest filled the horizon. Now there were dozens of streets, and the forest was a distant smudge. While the nephews waited, Jan, at his home a mile away, was sorting through personal papers. He also thought of a fire several years back after their hasty return from Amsterdam, a different and smaller fire only a dozen miles from Outre's Penobscot Bay house. He and Nikolaus had used this fire as their excuse to rescue the great pine table, fear of future incineration. They journeyed to the house. The daughter, Beatrix, was no beauty, but striking. She was young, perhaps 15 or 16, and rather lissom, quiet-spoken. Her black undressed hair hung loose, and this gave her a wild look that suited her brown Indian skin. But she greeted them in pleasant English and asked them into the house. They sat before the fire in the familiar room where the great table gleamed with waxy luster. She left them to admire it while she went to the kitchen. They heard the busy roar of the coffee grinder. Jan trailed his fingers over the deep amber wood, darkening with age.
"We must persuade her," he whispered.
Over the steaming coffee mixed with Dutch chocolate and cinnamon, no doubt supplied by Outre, Jan enlarged on their fears for the table should another fire break out, and Nikolaus expressed his certainty that their father, Charles Duquet, had intended it for the company office. She listened attentively. They waited. In the firelight, Nikolaus saw that Outre's daughter might be called exotically attractive. Finally, she spoke.
"That fire was distant, and the table," she said smoothly, "is, as you say, too large for any practical use. If you would send me a handsome small table, you may have this large one."
She rapped her knuckles on the pine. She said she did not know why Outre was so passionate about it. He asked after it in every letter and would undoubtedly be angry when she told him it was gone. She did not seem troubled by the promise of Outre's rage. Nor did she seem interested in knowing these stranger uncles who came so suddenly, who spoke dismissively of Outre as though he were a cast-off from the body of society. She retreated from the conversation and said nothing more while they talked eagerly on, telling her of the family history, of Duke and Son's many successes. Jan was sure she had heard a garbled and erroneous account from Outre, who had likely described the uncles as orphans with evil intentions who had cornered all power in the company. They invited her confidences, which were not forthcoming, and at last Jan and Nikolaus had no more to say. But the matter of the large table was settled. Despite this prize, the two aging men were discomfited. They left in an uncomfortable silence. Something was wrong.
"Like Outher in cold disposition," said Nikolaus. "Like an Indian in conversation," said Jan. "We were too easy. She is only a chit of a bastard girl. It would be justice to send the cramped oaken table we use in the anteroom," said Jan, "the one with the mended leg. No, let us send a fine table, however diminutive, so she need have no complaint, one of exotic wood and with well-carved legs. We'll send Pete, now that he's available, as well as a skilled carpenter and long-bed wagon to fetch it to Boston."
But it fell out differently. A month later, Pete, followed by a wagon, approached the gate of Duquet's old house with a ready smile. He was greeted by a growling mastiff. Afraid to open the gate and enter, he called out, "Hello, the house! Hello! Mademoiselle Duquet, are you at home?" The door flew open and the girl stood on the granite stone that served as top step. Her oval face was olive-toned and her hair blacker than soot.
"Who are you and what do you here, sir?"
she asked with the warmth of a January midnight.
"I'm your cousin, Pete Duke. My uncles Jan and Nikolaus Duke spoke with you in recent weeks past about Duke and Son's large business table in this house. I have come for it. And look, I have brought you this smaller mahogany table as you requested."
"I know nothing of this," she said. "There is no large business table here, and you may take your mahogany object away. Pray do not trouble me again, sir."
She closed the door with a hard swinging crash. Pete swore undying enmity for Beatrix and Outher and the table all the way to Boston. Nikolaus said only, "You must have spoken in a way that angered her." Useless to protest. Boston's population swelled to more than 150,000 people. England had seized New France and driven away the Acadians. Yet New France must be a disappointment compared to the extraordinarily rich income, more than 4,000 times greater than any timberland investment, from sugar and molasses in the West Indies. People felt time rushing past ever since England had adopted the Gregorian calendar and forced the colonies to do the same, robbing everyone of 11 days of life. And who could count the new inventions and occupations? Colleges emerged from raw ideas. Daring men invented river flatboats to penetrate the wilderness. Shipmasters, not content with trade or passengers, began to pursue whales for the costly and fine oil. Teacups suddenly had handles, an effete fad that Nikolaus thought would soon die out. And that fellow Franklin's inventions, the lightning rods, which had saved hundreds of churches and houses from destruction, and the stove, which encased fire safely. It was an exciting time to live. There had been changes in Duke and Sons after Bernard's death. Sedley had remarried, and his new wife Elizabeth was a pretty young widow who had family connections to the second cousin of a Wentworth aunt. And after nearly a year of grieving, Birgit, Bernard's old wife, had died. Then Nikolaus began his series of bouts with pneumonia. They had had to scramble to find a competent timber surveyor, but Sedley, who had at least some idea of what was needed, found two. Wolfgang Breitsprecher, a German forester newly arrived, and a French, Jacques Nadeau, who had worked with old Forgeron for a season in New France. These men were antagonists. There was a new bookkeeper to replace Hank Stain, Thomas Ashbridge, one of the first graduates of the College of New Jersey. With Wedge, Breitsprecher, Nadeau, and Ashbridge, Duke and Sons had let in the first outsiders. Pete had been engaged for a year to Silence Gibbon, but she changed her mind. It seemed he might stay a bachelor. George had married Marjorie Butthoff, and already had fathered two boys, Edward and Freegrace. There had been other events, one darkly mysterious. None of the cousins had ever understood the details of Birgit's death, only that it was, in some unknown way, unspeakable. She had been buried at sea to be with Bernard, as Pete's mother Mercy lamely explained. So, Pete thought, Aunt Birgit likely had had some deadly disease. He shuddered. He looked at his watch. Once more he called out to Wedge, asking if the papers were ready. The political men would arrive soon. He heard a sound in the anteroom. Now! But it was only George Pickering Duke, red face shining, who came in with a handful of additional papers.
All ready, Pete?
Of course.
This is important. This can make us, if we handle it correctly. I see it as our chance.
And I.
With God's grace, it will go to our advantage. Pray that Uncle Jan does not make an appearance.
They were safe from Nikolaus, who was ill. Sedley came in, stiff-faced and silent, but sending out a feeling of discontent and rancor. He was just getting over a cold, and his long, thin nose was still red with chafed, sore-looking nostrils. He and Pete were barely civil to one another.
Under a goose-down comforter, Nikolaus was thinking about that meeting. If Jan was there, he could prevent Pete's rash and headlong decisions. George Pickering Duke was as hopeless as Pete. He looked the part of a distinguished businessman, but the exterior masked a rather dim and credulous being. Best would be Sedley, who was more like Charles Duquet than any of the sons or grandsons, embittered, sharp, willful, full of purpose and drive. But Sedley held himself separate from the others. Nikolaus was sure that he would eventually dominate Pete and George Pickering Duke. If only, he thought, Bernard had fathered children, and those children had inherited some of Bernard's equitable, quiet character. If only hams and cakes could fly. If only it were always summer. Poor Bernard. And the shock he gave all of them. The memory of Birgit's extraordinary departure from the world forced its way into his mind. She sank rather quickly. One day she was well and busy, the next she was unable to rise from the bed. She complained of a headache, a twisting pain in her gut. Her mind wandered, her thin arms thrust up toward the ceiling. She called for Bernard, forgetting he was in Davy Jones's locker. Mercy and Sarah and Patience attended her bedside, fetching cold compresses, urging the sick woman to sup a little broth, which she promptly vomited up.
"You will be well again in a day or so," said Mercy. "It is an indisposition, nothing more."
But as the day wore on, the patient became more silent, concentrated on drawing ragged, bubbled breaths. She confounded them by dying in the late afternoon. One moment she seemed no worse. The next she stopped breathing. Mercy came out of the sick room and put the kettle on.
"She has just left us," she said. "She is with God."
"How can that be?"
asked Jan, who sat with Nikolaus at the table.
"I thought it was a fleeting illness."
"Apparently not. We never know when he will take us."
She sighed, lowered her eyes, then looked at Nikolaus.
"If you could order the coffin from Mr. Kent, Sarah and I will prepare her body. I think that rose silk dress she liked so well."
She did not cry. Death was too familiar and demanded its rituals. Older women were deeply familiar with the events of passage. She took the basin of warm water and dry cloths into the death room. She might have preferred to wait some time before this task, but Sarah and Patience had already stripped away the comforter and top sheet. To avoid handling the body more than was necessary, Sarah suggested they cut her nightgown off. It was soiled with dark vomit in any case. Mercy thought this a criminal idea. It was a good nightgown, and once washed and bleached, someone could use it. So they unbuttoned the high-necked gown and drew it upward over the thin shoulders, over the head, pulling the stick-like arms from the sleeves and tugging the garment higher over the knees, up the thin thighs, and... Nikolaus would never forget the way the door of the sick room flew open with the two women jammed in the opening. He and Jan had been sitting in mourning quiet, watching the flames in the fireplace.
Nikolaus! Jan! Come into this room!
Nikolaus had never heard his wife speak in that shocked tone. The scarlet-faced women half ran into the kitchen and let the men go in alone. The thin and wasted body of an elderly man lay on the still, sweat-damp sheet. It was Birgit. Certainly it was Birgit, but Birgit was a man. Indubitably. The wispy hairs on the narrow chest and the male sexual organs, shrunken and withered but quite real, confounded them. Nikolaus's mind seethed. He thought not of Birgit, but of Bernard. Why? Why? For 40 years! And none of them had known. He now wrenched his mind away from the still shocking image engraved in his memory. It was in the past. Instead, he thought of what was happening this very hour while he lay sick abed. Pete, Sedley, and George Pickering Duke trying to bargain with some of the shrewdest, most ruthless men in the colonies, men noted for their rapacious ways. There was no help for it. If it killed him, he had to go there. Coughing, he called Mercy.
My clothes. I must go to that meeting.
You cannot. I forbid it. You are ill, dangerously ill.
Let me alone, Mercy. I must go, I tell you. Help me if you wish me to live. Bar me from this, and I'll die of spite.
She thought he could do that. The Dukes were nothing if not stubborn and willful. He caught Jan descending from his carriage in front of the Duke building. Pete, George Pickering, Sedley, and their invited guests sat around the oval mahogany table. The Wentworth brother-in-law's heavy mouth twitched and twitched with a small smile. The proposition was unusual. They would shower the Duke brothers and nephews with social invitations. They would encourage useful connections. They would make the Duke family known, not only in Boston society, but in England. In return, they wanted free access to the Duke Pineland holdings in the North Country, for which, of course, they would pay a fair price. They would share equally the costs of getting the logs out of the forest and to the mills. George Pickering Duke thought it a good agreement, as everyone knew that the way to gain advantages was through political and social connections, connections Duke and Sons had never enjoyed. Pete was a little concerned over the free access phrase. How free did these political men imagine such access might be? Sedley was in a cold sweat with visions of 1,000 choppers cutting their pine, perhaps these very men presenting false accounts or smoothly saying that other men, unknown, had stolen the logs. Worse yet, once given this opening, they were in a position to tamper with the law and seize Duke forest lands. But before Pete could say done, the door opened and the two aged Duke brothers, Jan and Nikolaus, came in. Nikolaus looked half-dead, pasty-faced except for burning fever spots on his cheeks. He threw his black cane on the table, looked at the Wentworth brother-in-law and his cronies. Pete explained the offer. The Wentworth brother-in-law, not liking the look of the old men, softened the offer a little by saying that they would only cut on mutually agreed-upon plots. The words free access were not spoken this time. Nikolaus said,
Out.
Out, repeated Jan. Out now. The meeting is finished. We agreed to nothing.
Thank God, murmured Sedley, emboldened to pick up Nikolaus's cane as if he would use it on the political men if they made an intention to stay. But as the men left, they treated the elderly Dukes to looks of pure malevolence. The Dukes would never be invited to even the meanest dogfight after this. It took an hour and more for them to convince Pete and George Pickering Duke that they had been saved from a perilous fate that would have ruined Duke and Sons. Nikolaus said,
Pete, I know that your mother Mercy has long wanted to put us into a brighter social light,
But Jan and I feel it would be best if this company now cultivated a quiet presence. We should be more stealthy in our operations and avoid partnership entanglements. Try to keep everything in the family as much as we can. Use straw men for land purchases. We do not want Duke and Sons trumpeted about as a great power or even as important. If we remain quiet, grey, and invisible, we will have advantages over our competitors. In fact, they were afraid that details of Birgit's death would leak into Boston gossip if the Duke women consorted with society in drawing rooms. Under the influence of a glass of sherry, anything might be said. Pete and George looked sulky, like chastised schoolboys. Sedley's red mouth was fixed in a wolfish grin. The old uncles left the room and went down the stairs. At the bottom, Jan said, "We may have trouble from Pete and George." Nikolaus coughed.
"I love my son Pete, but I put my money on Sedley."
Nikolaus said,
"We can't die now. We have to get Sedley in position."
But he began to cough again as though his end was at hand. Jan saw him home, where Mercy prodded him to the bed. She and the servant girls brought mustard plasters, syrups, hot bricks, cups of boiling chamomile tea, and a beaker of imported Malmsey. He would recover. In the weeks that followed, Sedley came every day to sit by his father's bedside and encourage his health. Jan came often, and the three parlayed. Sedley's ideas, which he had long nurtured in secret, were expansive. He talked, the strong, highly colored face animated, his dark eyes glittering. A businessman's face, thought Nikolaus. High praise. "We are too narrow in our holdings, Father, though it was a good move to get out of Carolina. We are concentrated in New England, which has become a hotbed of grasping men with shipping interests and many in their hire. But I believe the future in New England, in Boston, to be very constrained as long as England controls our destinies. We need banks, we need insurance, we need regulated markets, we need a set currency. Skilled workmen are moving to Portsmouth, to Salem and other towns as business languishes in Boston. The population is dropping. England's hand squeezes us."
"What would you have us do?"
The sick man lay aslant stiff pillows. "For the long plan, I would wish us to look into the timber of the Ohio Valley and north and west of there. There is a group of men in Virginia who are taking up much of that land. They have their eyes on the future. Forest land can be had for almost nothing. We should explore the region and see what might be valuable. We must, I feel, be more adventurous. Forests need consideration many years before they become money in the pocket."
"You have the right attitude. Better than falling back on cozy local contacts with important men who will be unimportant tomorrow. What other ideas have you? I know you have been considering ways to strengthen the business."
"I have. And you know, ever since I was a child, I have heard that Duke and Sons thought it advantageous to own a shipyard. And yet, when Grandfather Duque disappeared, so did the idea. I think the time has long passed for a bargain shipyard, but I still feel we should act as soon as possible and acquire. That is my second idea. Think, one ship with a load of sawed planks to the French West Indies would pay for the vessel. And if that ship should return with a load of molasses or sugar..."
"Ah," said Jan, "but who would manage this shipyard?"
"Uncle, I think George Pickering could make a success of it. He has often regretted that he was not able to go to sea as you two did when you were young. A maritime interest is there. His knowledge of English law might be an advantage, and he needs a controlling position of some sort."
"And what of Pete?"
"I suggest he head Duke and Sons here in Boston. He will remain as the company figurehead. And I think Duke and Sons should consider shifting out of Boston. All is so muddled here, so lackadaisical and awry. Boston seems to me always in a lunatic mood, always suspicious that some entity is usurping its rights."
"That may be a well-founded suspicion," said Jan.
"Perhaps. But I think we will need a place with more vigorous businessmen, with less interference from England.
Boston has ever been England's spaniel. Nikolaus coughed phlegmily and said,
Even spaniels will bite if provoked. And something I find extremely trying is the masts on British ships, masts that we cut from our forest lands. The vaunted English navy is constructed from New England timbers. Our pines and oaks come back to us, eh?
But he thought it would be better to leave Boston to its aloof cliques and fulminating gossip. Jan nodded, but did not want to get into this uneasy topic. What place are you thinking of, Sedley? Privately, he thought it would be difficult. They had been in Boston for decades.
New York, or Philadelphia. Men there are inclined to take the longer sight of possibilities.
Jan thought Sedley had considered well, up to a point.
You have mentioned the advantages of a boy going to sea to build character and confidence. You have given thought to the future. And yet you do not mention the possibility of sending your own son, James, to sea. He is of an age when he might be enrolled as a midshipman.
Sedley frowned. He habitually avoided the boy, who had been sent away to school as early as possible.
You surprise me, Uncle. You who forbade George to go to sea.
George Pickering was beguiled by hornpipes and wharf swagger. He wished to go as a sailor before the mast. I propose an aim rather higher. James is a bright and quick youngster who might well advance in a naval career before taking up his place in the business. It is important to bring on the young sons, and it will set an example for the other boys of the family. I have no doubt that we can make use of our maritime connections to secure him a midshipman's place on board a good ship.
I will think about it, Sedley said.
But he was already considering that to place James as a Royal Navy midshipman would be a step to the enemy's side, with the colonial feeling against England stronger every year. He would look into placing the boy on an American privateer.
Do, said Nikolaus.
Part 5. In the Lumber Camps. 1754 to 1804. 38. The House on Penobscot Bay. A month after Kuntaw's leaving in the year of 1754, his wife Malan sat in the weak autumn sunlight outside the English trading post when a white man they called Simon kicked her leg lightly and gestured for her to follow him. He said nothing, and she said nothing, but he kept her in his room all winter. In the spring, the man returned to England, and she went with Richard Tarbox. Her son, Tawny Sell, grew up around the post, running with the omnipresent dogs and scruffy knot of untended children. They made themselves a kind of wild den under the old canoes. Malan showed only fitful interest in Tawny or in the women from the Mi'kmaq village who came several times to coax her from the current white man who kept her, but she was furious when they tried to take Tawny away.
He should be brought up by Mi'kmaq people, said the women. And am I not a Mi'kmaq person? I will keep him here at the post. He will learn white man ways. Mi'kmaq ways not good now.
Too deep in private despair to bother with the child, who did well enough on his own, she existed on a narrow ledge of life that was neither Mi'kmaq nor white, going with whichever man nodded at her or gave her food. She grew fat. She slept prodigiously, night and day, difficult to arouse, as though it was too painful to rise from the submergence.
Ah, said one of the old women, I remember when she was a girl. She was clever. She made fine quill embroidery.
No one knew what had changed her into the somnolent, distant woman. Some said she was sick with the white man whiskey disease. Others said it was love for Kuntaw and shame at his abandonment. They had all heard that Kuntaw was living with a white woman in Maine. He had not come back, and no one had gone to talk him back. Some said Malan had divorced Kuntaw. They had married as children. Soon after Kuntaw, Auguste and Achille had returned from their moose hunt to find ruin. In sorrow, Achille had left his lonely and grieving son, a boy so sore in heart he could not accept that he and Malan were too young for marriage. Elfege had forbidden it,
but Kuntar argued that he had killed his moose. Now he was a man. He would marry. Elfej was not his father and could not deny him. They married, and Malan bore their son, Tani. She had only 13 winters, and her labor was long and painful. Before the child was 3, Kuntar left for the lumber camps, and Malan discovered white man's whiskey. The boy ran with a pack of orphaned and abandoned children. From the older women who sometimes coaxed Tani into their wigwams to feed him good moose meat, to tell him that he could always come to them for food and shelter, he heard stories about his father, Grasshopper Slayer, and his skill with bow and arrow at a time when Mi'kmaq men preferred white man guns. It embarrassed him to have a father called Grasshopper Slayer. Now only a few feeble oldsters still kept their unstrung bows and time-warped arrows. Every Mi'kmaq man had a gun, and it was possible even for an inept hunter to kill 5 or 6 geese from a distance. Food was easier to get, and there was little reason to spend long hours tracking and stalking keen-witted prey. Tawny was a sly thief and beggar. He had neither bow nor gun and depended on his wits for food and shelter. He ran errands for white men, slept under an upturned canoe or in a sapling lean-to he had scuffled together in the broken woods. At 14, he and Hanna, a girl whose mother also hung around the post, began to sleep together under old canoes, and while still very young, they made 3 children, Elise, Amboise, and Ginot, who all managed to live, scrabbling around the post like young turkeys. Then Hanna, too, who liked rum and the free wild feeling it gave, began to go with white men, and when she was 20, she was beaten to death by Henry Clefford, a jealous and bellicose trader who kept 2 other Mi'kmaq women. It was early spring, windy, cold days mixed with sleet and intermittent sunlight. "Here I leave," said Tawny to his mother Malan, smarting with hatred and sorrow. He despised her. Why should he tell her anything? "I am grown. I am a father. I go. My children go with me."
"You leave here," she said flat-toned. "Always I know this."
She nodded and turned away, yawning one of her deep, deep, gaping yawns. He could say nothing else. Her wretched life was with the post. He was now grown, strong, but without hunting skills or weapons, ignorant of animal behavior, which was men's correct interest and work. He no longer belonged here, if ever he had. He woke one morning, his eyes fixed on the underside of the broken canoe, the children wedged under his arm, and turned away from this life. He would no longer be part of the tattered Mi'kmaq people whose customs had fallen off like flakes of dead skin. But he still believed that his children should live with blood kin. He felt a bitter sadness for them, nearly orphans, with a dead mother and a worthless father. He could not leave them at that pernicious post. He knew only that his father was in a place called Penobscot Bay. Unannounced, paddling a stolen canoe and walking for weeks in mud and old snow, often carrying Ginot, the youngest, he found the house of Kuntar and the white man woman. Year after year, the logs of the old house had darkened almost to black. It seemed to be settling into the earth, but new cedar shingles shone like precious metal in the sunrise. The paint on the door and shutters had faded to a moss-gray color, something that made Beatrix think they must be repainted. Kuntar paid no attention to house chores beyond getting in the winter wood and hunting. "Enter you," Beatrix Duque called when she heard the scratching on the door. Tawny and the children stepped inside, ragged and travel-worn. They stood on the polished boards, smelling the strange odors of the household, seeing the slant light dropped through glass windows, reflecting from mirrors. Beatrix, gray-black hair streaming down her back like water, drew in a quick breath.
"Who are you?"
She stared at them.
"Who are you?"
But Tawny thought she must know.
"I, Tawny. Kuntar Sel, my father. These, my children. Kuntar, their grandfather. their mother dead. Names Elise, Amboise, Ginot.
As he turned them toward her, he touched each child on the forehead.
No good live Mi'kmaq place now. I grown man, but no good. I pretty bad man. I come, my father Kuntaw, you. Help them.
Ah,
said Beatrix. She looked at the children. Elise, at 9, the oldest, withdrawn and shy. 7-year-old Amboise, also shy, but with a winning smile. And Ginot, almost 5, with a plump, merry face.
Sit at the table. I will give you food.
The chairs were strange and high, the table like the goods counter in the post. Ginot struggled to get on a chair until Beatrix lifted him up, found him warm and heavy, gave him a small squeeze.
There you are, Snosypos, sweetie pie,
she said, then turned to Tawny.
Oh, poor Tawny, you must tell me everything, everything that has happened. Kuntaw is out hunting with our sons, Francis Outre and Josim. They are close to the ages of your children. I know Kuntaw will weep with happiness to see you.
He has spoken to me many times of his son, Tawny, and wondered if he still lived and how things were with him.
She felt a flash of compassion for this young man who resembled the handsome Indian striding into her life years past.
And now you are here. How happy he will be. But you are so young to be the father of 3 such big children.
She looked at them.
Elise, Amboise, can you read or write?
They bent their faces low.
Ginot, what do you like best? Get sugar stick at post. Ah, well, I have no sugar sticks, but I think you will like pancakes and some Dutch cocoa.
You good, said Tawny. I dream it, you good.
He and Beatrix exchanged looks, Beatrix's steady eyes a promise that the children were safe. Tawny's returned gaze showed a distance that could not be traversed. They were licking their plates for the last drops of maple syrup when Kuntaw came in with Francis Outre and Josim. Tawny's children threw quick, shy glances at their uncles, their black eyebrows and hair, their pale eyes. Josim carried a tom turkey by its feet, the bloody beak dragging along the floor. When Kuntaw grasped who the strangers were, his face swelled, his hands trembled. He could barely speak, but croaked,
Stay, stay, we all live here.
He looked at Beatrix, his eyebrows drawn together beseechingly. So that is how it is, Tawny thought coldly. Kuntaw likely had to plead for favors from this tall woman who looked Indian when she stood in the shadowed corner of the room. He thought she was not one to stand in shadowy corners, and in full hard light she showed her white man blood in those water-clear eyes. But she spoke the Mi'kmaq language better than Tawny or the children, who got along with a rough scramble of Mi'kmaq, French, and English words. While Kuntaw, Francis Outre, Josim, and Tawny went upstairs, she took the children around the big house, explaining the use of each room to them, especially the room with a vast table. This, she said, was the schoolroom, the scholakal, where they would learn to read and write. She would teach them. She sat at the table and took Ginot on her lap, whispered to him that on the morrow she would make him a little toy horse, drew Elise and Amboise close. She spoke to them in a low, intimate voice, confiding her reasons.
Our people had special ones among them, those who remembered old stories, old ways. My mother died when I was a baby, and she told me nothing. But from my father, even though he was a Dutchman, I learned that Indian people must take whatever is useful from the white men. It is just, because they have taken everything from us. Many of our people died with secrets locked in their heads. Now it is good for us to learn how to read and write, so we may know how we make useful things, how our grandfathers lived. That is why we learn to read, so we can remember.
Gineau was afraid of the tall staircase, for he had never seen more than 3 steps, and snivelled until Beatrix took his hand and led him up very many, counting
7, 8, 9, 13.
Up in the attic they found Kuntal and Big Josime pushing ancient trunks, broken furniture, boxes of books, and Kuntal's worn-out bows and old quivers against the wall to make room for pallets.
"You will have this for your sleeping place," Beatrix said.
Gineau saw Josime roll his eyes as though she had said she was going to give roast moose to a pack of wolves. He smiled at Josime as only Gineau could smile, and Josime twitched his lips in amusement. Gineau wanted to please this woman, his father Tani, his grandfather Kuntal, even Josime and Francis Outher, who were ready to dislike their new kinfolk. Tani and the children were awkward eating at a table, but Beatrix signed they should not sit on the floor. They were cowed by the many dishes of meat and bread, unknown pottage, and something that looked like a fish. Francis Outher and Josime whispered and laughed together, took up their bowls and headed outside to eat far from the newcomers. Kuntal called them back.
"In your places."
They ate in silence. After dinner, Beatrix put Tawny's children to bed. Josime leaned against the doorframe, listening.
"I will tell you 2 stories," said Beatrix in a low, slow voice. "Listen. Here is the first one. Long ago, in the old days, 3 children were lost in the forest, and in that forest they saw a tree, a very strong big tree, so tall its leaves tickled the clouds. The tree was old, old, so old all the other trees called it Old Woman Tree, except the clouds, who said it was Old Foolish Tree. It was big." She stretched her arms wide apart to show its girth. "And for many years it grew in the forest. It was so big it had a great hollow at the bottom, and in there lived 2 bear people.
As they went down the stairs, hearing Beatrix's murmuring voice above, Kuntal put his hand on Tani's shoulder.
"Come outside with me and walk to the river. The recent rain fattened the river and disturbed the weir. While we mend it, I want you to tell me of Ma'lan and Migamagi. Do not spare me."
They waded in, shifted stones. Tani watched Kuntal to see how it was done, replacing those the current had dislodged. The sky was overcast, a leaden, dreary day of biting damp. The water numbed their feet and legs. Tani talked haltingly, then furiously. Told of Malan's lethargy, her withdrawal into a silent world, the white men who pulled her about. He told of Hana and how her wildness with the same white men had brought about her death.
"Henley Clawfoot. I would kill him if I stayed there. Many times I want kill all."
"You did well, my son, to bring your children here. I will care for them as I should have cared for you. I will pay for my neglect of Ma'lan and our people. I know well my earlier life was one of wrong behavior and loss. I did not teach you the things you need to know."
They came out of the water, pulled on their umkasan, and began to walk back to the house in silence, Kuntal opening his mouth several times, until at last he began.
"It is not winter, but I will tell you the old stories of our people, and the great ones in our lineage."
He did not wait for Tani's reply, but began to speak of warriors and hunters, of ancestors, but could not tell of the horror of seeing his mother's severed arm, of Achille's disappearance, his own years searching for that missing father. All the time he spoke, he felt he was talking to the sky. The sky, as unmoved as Tawny, responded with a chill fine mist that thickened into steady rain.
Kuntaw said,
I went from one tree to another, unthinking, never reflecting on you, my first son. But now I see I was not a good man. I should not have looked for Ashil. I should have stayed with you and Malan. So I say, you should not leave your children.
Tani shrugged. The more Kuntaw spoke, the colder grew his feeling for this father. He called him by name.
Kuntaw, I do not belong here. I do not belong in Mi'kma'ki, Nova Scotia, they say it now. I am apart from every person, English, Mi'kmaq, French, American. I have no place. Many Mi'kmaq people in the village pretend all is well, but the animals are scarce, and no one knows the correct way to live. White people take the berries, the clams, the fish, and sell them. I cannot pretend. I have told you how things are at the English post. You have this woman. I have no one. I not belong. No place good for me. I go away. Maybe somebody kill me soon. Then I be done.
So he said, with rain trickling from his hair, soaking his shoulders. The rain became a deluge. Kuntaw felt needles of fear in his throat when he heard these words. Was this his son, or a malignant spirit in his shape? It was true that Tawny appeared different, not as two-spirit people are different, but more white, bad white. He was nicked everywhere with old scars, his features bunched in a scowl. He spoke in a hoarse voice. He was dirty and ill-clothed. Kuntaw wondered what he truly was, this isolate and unknowable young man. But he smiled numbly and said,
Foolish words. You still young. You have a place here. You did a good thing to bring the children here. Do not inflict the wrong that I did you on them. Stay here with me. Stay.
He was afraid the white men had broken this abandoned son. It rained all night, and a heavy fog made the world impenetrable, yet Tawny said he would go. He would try New Brunswick for work.
I hope to come back for you,
he mumbled to Elise, Amboise, and Gino. He met Kuntaw's censorious eyes boldly. Had he not done the same? Yes, Kuntaw wordlessly agreed. He had done the same. There was little work. The lumber camps were the only places that would hire Indians, considered disposable labor. Good enough, as long as they lasted, and for water work, the best, while they stayed among the living. From a lumber camp, Tawny thought, he could always move deeper into the forest, though he had no gun. He thought about trying to live in the forest without a gun, without knowing the ways of animals. Would he go to a city? To Boston? Would he find something or someone? He had to find a new way. He would try the lumber camps first. And so he went to a chaotic world of groaning trees that ripped holes in the canopy, felled other trees, snapped off halfway, exploded into splinters. Some trees refused to come down, locking their branches into nearby neighbors, teetering on half-gnawed stumps. A few, on the edge of a new clearing and unprotected by the fallen hundreds, waited for the windstorms that would sweep them flat in great waves, uprooted, clods of dirt dropping with small sounds. He worked through the winter limbing felled pine, and in the spring drive the boss ordered him into a bateau. He was an Indian, and by birth, skilled with the paddle. But Tawny's knowledge of bateaus was that they were shelters, roofs that had protected him from the rain in his childhood. He was no riverman. Before he could collect his season's pay, he drowned below Wolf Falls and, like countless other fathers, slipped into the past. At the house on Penobscot Bay, Kuntaw's failure to make Tawny an instant Mi'kmaq wrenched his heart. He withdrew a little from Beatrix. He spoke to Amboise, too young to understand,
I am shamed I left Migamagi, my people and my son.
He saw himself without pity as one who was witlessly destroying the ancient ways. Although he reflected that the larch loses its needles, the maple and beech their leaves, standing bare until gleaming new leaves open again, Mi'kmaq people were putting out very few fresh leaves, and he, none at all. 1,000 times Kuntaw had heard Beatrix say, "I need you, Indian man," as she had the day she rode up to him on her horse. At first he thought she meant she needed him to split wood for her. As the weeks passed, he thought she meant she needed him for sex. But one day he understood. She needed him because she was a half-Indian woman who had been brought up as a white man girl. She needed him to make her an Indian. She had been leading him into books, but now that he knew, he pushed the books aside.
"Woman," he said, "now I will teach you to read."
And he led her into the forest, patiently explaining, as he should have done with Tawny, how to understand and decipher the tracks of animals, the seasonal signs of plants and trees, the odors of bears and coming rain, of frost-leathered leaves, the changing surface of water, intimating how it all fitted together.
"These are things every Mi'kmaq person knows," he said. "And now do you understand that the forest and the ocean shore are tied together with countless strings as fine as spiderweb silks? Do you begin to glimpse Indian ways and learning? I would not wish an ignorant wife."
"Yes," Beatrix said, "but it is too much to remember."
"Not to remember like a lesson," he said, "but to know, to feel."
He knew this was hopeless. She soon begged off these excursions.
"I have told you my Passamaquoddy mother died when I was very young, before she could teach me anything. It is a pity. What I know, I learned from my father. I had to learn the medicinal plants. He often wrote to me from Leiden and asked to have certain pungent leaves sent to him."
But this father out her, who never returned, yet bombarded Beatrix with letters and advice, with packets of books and outmoded European garments, died abroad a year before Kuntaw came out of the woods to her. He thought of Beatrix's father, if he thought of him at all, as a white man, all fiery will and command, but with many affectations. He was glad that an ocean and death lay between them. Beatrix taught the children their letters and numbers, gave them books to read, and Kuntaw, who had failed to teach Tawny, now showed his grandchildren what Francis Outher and Josime already knew, how to hunt, to paddle a canoe. The boys stuck to him like burrs, and together they prowled the shrinking woodlands, carved and whittled, mended garments, stewed eels, coaxed fish into their hands.
"You must learn these things," said Kuntaw. "You who are more unconscious of the world than stones. You are Mi'kmaq blood, but you know nothing."
He showed them animals, plants, and yes, grasshoppers as prey. He fashioned child-sized bows for Amboise and Ginot. Let them hunt grasshoppers even as he had. Let them not be ignorant of Mi'kmaq ways. Yet he found it impossible to teach them everything he knew unless all could live inside the Mi'kmaq life. It was more than knowing how to use certain tools or recognize plants. What he taught was not a real life. It was only a kind of play, he thought gloomily. That world he wanted them to know had vanished, as smoke deserts the dying embers that made it. All around the Penobscot settlement the trees fell, tracks inched through the forests, only one or two, then seven, then webs of trails that over the decades widened into roads. The roads were muddy, sometimes like batter, sometimes thick and clutching until late summer, when they metamorphosed into choking dust so fine it hung in the air long after a horse and carriage passed, settling on the grass as the English people settled on the land. The years passed, and logging companies and settlers stripped the banks of the bay and moved up the Penobscot. Fields of wheat and hay took the land, these fields enclosed by linked stumps. The root wads of the forest that had once stood there turned on their edges to bar the white man's cows and sheep. Along the shore, settlers' houses were stitched into tight rows by paling fences. The old Charles Duquet house sat alone in its acreage, surrounded by forest that had never been cut, a relic of the wooden world. A day came when Beatrix noticed her son Josime giving Elise glances that were not brotherly, and said to Quintal that perhaps it was time she was married. Elise was 15, rather old to be single. Quintal's advice was to send her to Nova Scotia to stay with his sister Aladonia. There she might find a Mi'kmaq husband. There she might live a Mi'kmaq life. He had forgotten what Tani had said of the place, remembered only the good days before the moose hunt of his childhood. Everyone noticed how the little girls of the settlement, whether Indian, French, Métis, or English, wanted to be with Jeannot. They ran to meet him, told him their small secrets, and swore him not to tell. He never did. Brought him pieces of ginger cake stolen from the home pantries. Beatrix, who watched them whispering, asked, "What do they tell you, Jeannot?" "Tell me worms, funny frogs, just nothing." The conversations were loaded with giggles. Few girls, or later women, could resist Jeannot's impish, smiling ways. "Stay that way, dear child," murmured Beatrix, who was not immune to his charm. Quintal also watched Jeannot and noticed he was different, as some Mi'kmaq of the old days were different. The name for the difference escaped him. The wooden world extended out into the bay in the shape of watercraft. Amboise and Jeannot Selle played with the village boys on the wharves, ran, balanced, and jumped on the floating logs in the sawmill ponds, pretending they were on a log drive. The heroes of all were the rivermen riding the logs down the surly Penobscot. The boys around the bay paddled canoes and rowed skiffs. As they grew, they worked with fishermen, learned to mend and cast nets and haul lines, and the sons of the fishermen pulled for deeper water when they, too, joined the maritime trade. Day after day, the children watched men loading mast ships with the great pine spars, stacking plank lumber on decks. The Selle children went with Quintal to mend the weirs, to help drive and catch eels, their dependable and favored food. For the town boys, the ideal future was to chop great pines and ride the boiling waters of the spring freshets. For Jeannot and Amboise Selle, it was an irresistible pull. The children grew up too rapidly, Beatrix thought. One day they were children, still full of questions and innocent enthusiasms, and the next day they were grown men with tempers and ideas who preferred Quintal's company to hers. When Francis Outher turned 21 and married a half-French, half-Mi'kmaq girl, he and the girl's father built a small cabin for the young couple. Then Josime left home, going to the New Brunswick lumber camps. A month later, it was Amboise's turn to go to the woods. For Jeannot Selle, the only one left, time passed very slowly. For him, the year dragged on. Spring arrived, and he watched the acres of logs that escaped the mills float down the river and into the bay, envied the jaunty rivermen who prodded and corralled the dumb timber. After the drive, Amboise, broader and stronger, came home with tremendous stories, and money, too. Summer came and faded. Amboise left again to work as a swamper for a New Brunswick outfit. For weeks, the cries of geese rang like blacksmiths hammering lofty anvils. The moon waxed full, lunatic clouds racing across its face. Jeannot suffered from a restless urge to go somewhere. One morning, his decision made, he went to Quintal.
"Grandfather, I am old enough and I want to go to the forest camps to cut trees," he said.
Quintal nodded.
"I know you think of starting a man's life," he said, "although there are many girls who maybe think you better stay. You have been warm with these girls. Is it not possible many children here will call you father?"
Jeannot, shocked, said, "No, no.
Grandfather, the girls only talk to me. Girls like to talk to somebody. We are friends.
Kuntal looked at his grandson with an assessing, weighing eye, putting wispy thoughts together.
Yes, I see. I see you. I am old, Gino, but do not take me for a fool. If you were among Mi'kmaq people, they would see no wrong in a man who has a double spirit. But white men call it bad, and those churchmen.
There was nothing to say to this. In a moment, Kunta continued.
When will you go?
Today. I have warm clothes in a hide bag. Shall I take an axe?
Have an axe if you wish, but the lumber camp will give you as many as you need. They provide the tools. This I know, for I too worked in those camps, chopping trees, even as my father Achille did, and his father, the Frenchman, René Sel, before him.
I did not know of the Frenchman, René. He is our ancestor.
He was my grandfather, murdered, they said, by a girl he adopted. So you see, we have French blood in us. But René Sel did not work in lumber camps. He cut trees for himself. Gino, before you go into the forest, I want you to travel with Amboise to Mi'kma'ki and see Elise. See if she is well, if she has children. We have heard nothing. And I want you to inquire if my cousin Auguste, son of my deceased Aunt Noé, is still alive. He was a person always in trouble, so he may be dead. Though I have noticed that many people who cause trouble live long lives. If he is alive, I want him to come here and stay with us. And take care. The woods and rivers are full of English and Americans fighting. Stay distant if you hear firearms.
Amboise, who was very strong and heavy-shouldered, and Gino, waving farewell to a bouquet of girls on the wharf who called his name, went by ship up the coast to Halifax, made a foot journey to the post.
"I do not have a good feeling for Elise," said Amboise. "I remember Tawny said Mi'kma'ki was a bad place."
In his pocket he had a small wooden turkey he had carved long ago, an object that amused Elise when she was young.
"If she has children," he said, "I thought maybe they like to play with this."
"Amboise, that is a good idea. I wish I had brought something, even a pine cone."
Kunta's sister Aladonia, thin and with many teeth missing, made much of them, pointed out certain people with the patronym Sel, and told them that yes, Auguste still lived.
"That one, he is too bad to die."
But Amboise and Gino saw the Mi'kmaq village was a hungry, sad place, a mix of wigwams and white man cabins. The eel weirs were in disrepair, and rarely did the men make an effort to put them in order. It was easier to eat bread and pork from the agency than catch eels. Lucien Brassois, Elise's husband, lay drunk in the mud beside their wigwam, whose torn bark covering needed repairs. They were sorry for Elise, who cried and said she had lost a baby girl whom she had called Bee after Beatrix.
"I thought married would be like Beatrix and Grandfather Kunta, nice, laughing, you know?"
She wept women's tears. While they were in the chopped lands of what once had been Mi'kma'ki, they heard stories of Kunta's father Achille, the great hunter. For some reason, these stories made Amboise resentful.
"Everything yesterday, everything good happens long ago. Now, oh, now."
His eyes narrowed.
"Elise, if Brassois is not good to you, you must come with us."
They knew that Brassois was not good to her. Guilty and uneasy, they wanted to get away. Old Auguste had succumbed to drink. They found him at the wigwam of one of his granddaughters, bleary and nodding, sitting outside squinting at whatever happened there. When they told him they were Kunta's grandsons, he roused a little, huffing out rum breath, gave a bitter smile, and said Kunta had had a fortunate life, unlike him. He spoke in an old man voice, then clamped his mouth shut. They sat together and watched the dozen idle Mi'kmaq men who hung around the post like flies on meat. Amboise was surprised to see tears running down wicked old Auguste's face as he watched them.
"They have nothing to do. When Kuntal and I were of those years," he said,